Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. This is the UDRP Locking Implementation Review Team meeting for the 18th of March, 2014. On the call today, we have Christine Durain, Luke Soufer, and Matt Schneller. And from ICANN staff, we have Caitlin Tubergen and Barry Cobb. Christine, are you still having a problem with your mic? You may want to dial into the Adobe Bridge. The bridge number is pasted into the chat room.
Hi, this is Christine.
Hi, Christine.
So the email said that the audio was enabled. That's why I was expecting it to be. If it hadn't said that, I wouldn't have even tried. I would have just dialed in. So maybe this next time the email goes out, it shouldn't say that the audio is enabled.
Okay. The audio should be enabled, but there might be some sort of technical glitch right now, so I apologize for that.
Oh, so it was the intention for it to be enabled. Okay.
Yes, it is. It was. Okay, so what I have in the Adobe room right now is the revised rules. So thank you to Christine, Luke, and McKaylee for adding comments. I see that Marika just joined. Hi, Marika. So what I wanted to do today was to briefly go over the comments that were submitted and make sure that everyone is okay with them, or where clarification is needed, we can add some clarification. So the first comment is in the definitions, and that applies to locking of domain names. And I don't think I think what Luke added was quite helpful. I don't see any issues with that, but I'll read it aloud just so that to see if everyone is okay with it. So lock is a set of measures that a registrar applies to a domain name which prevents any modification to it by the registrant, but does not affect the resolution of the domain name or the renewal of the domain name. Is everyone okay with that?
Can just... Hi, Caitlin. Sorry, this is Jo Tang from WIPO. I just called in a few minutes late. I do apologize.
Oh, hi, Jo. It's okay.
Just trying to get into the conference room on Adobe Connect, and it's not working for me. Just let me get that going.
Okay. Barry had his hand raised, so go ahead, Barry.
Just a quick, and I'm trying to recollect from the working group, and maybe Christine, you'll be able to refresh my memory, or Luke. Wasn't there a discussion about when this lock is applied that name servers could still be adjusted? And if that's true, should we call that out in more detail here with this definition?
It is correct that we defined lock. I'll have to pull up that old document. It's correct that we defined lock as only affecting the who is, the ability to update the who is, or to transfer the domain name, I guess, maybe not even the who is, but and to allow the, to not do anything to the name servers. I'm not sure if that belongs here in the definition section or down below. I'll have to think about that, or the group will have to discuss that. But you're right that was the discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Luke, did you have any comments to add to that? No? Okay. Okay. We can move forward to the next definition. One thing that nobody actually commented on was the definition of pendency, and I just wanted to make sure that that was okay.
I think this is Christine from NAV. I think that you pulled this right out of the lock document, right?
Yes.
That's why no one commented.
Okay, so the only thing I added was that pendency was defined as when the proceeding began, but didn't have an end to it. And I didn't know if I should add something, for example, like to the time the UDRP decision has been implemented or the UDRP provider has withdrawn the proceeding in the event that a decision is never implemented.
Oh, I see. Yes, I see. It begins, not ends. I see that note now. Yeah, that's probably a good point.
Okay.
To say that the UDRP decision has been implemented or the case terminates by some other means, which could be, you know, through, you know, the parties jointly withdraw it or the forum or the WIPO or whatever, you know, unilaterally dismiss the case. So there's other ways the case can end. So, yeah, that's probably a good idea to add in the end point.
Okay. Well, I will go ahead and do that. I'm going to go to the next comment. And the next comment was in reference to, and this was another comment by Luke, and I thought it was a good point, which is in the notification of complaint stage 4B. The registrar shall provide the information requested in the verification request and confirm that a lock of the domain name has been applied within 2 business days. Did anyone have any comments about that?
What page are you on? Because I'm not seeing that on my screen, and I don't have the ability to control my own screen.
Sorry, let me, I lost network connectivity for a second.
Okay.
We are on page 5. Can everyone see that now? I apologize for the technical glitches today. So this is in B.
Yep.
I had originally said that the registrar shall verify the information in the verification request. And Luke added shall provide the information requested. And I think that's actually better wording. So thank you for that, Luke.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Anybody else?
Did we have anything on paragraph A, selenium deficiency check?
That is in recommendation 3.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just added some text. So the provider shall perform a preliminary deficiency check of the complaint before submitting a verification request to the registrar. No, go ahead.
So this is Christine from NAF. That was one thing I didn't say anything about because I hadn't pulled up the final to compare it to. But I don't know that it was the intention of the group to, like, codify that practice. I mean, WIPO and NAF both said that we already, you know, do a glance of the complaint to make sure that the, you know, that it's not just, you know, written on a cocktail napkin and scanned in. But I'm a little bit concerned that we, you know, by codifying this preliminary deficiency check, we're somehow building in a whole bunch of additional administrative hassles around it. So that's one thing I should have commented on and didn't.
Yeah, that's one thing I was actually going to say, but thank you, Christine, for saying it for me. As in, we at WIPO do a check to say, as you said, it's not written on a cocktail napkin, that it's actually an actual proper complaint. Which is already done here in practice, whether or not codifying it is necessary. Again, I'm following Christine on that one.
Okay. I see that Marika has her hand raised. Go ahead, Marika.
Marika, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah,
sorry. I forgot I actually didn't connect my audio, so I just want so the only comment would be then that probably you would need to change the A to still notify or indicate that the registrar can accept a verification request. So I think in the sequence, it's important that, you know, that is specified, I guess, in A, so that the registrar or it follows and logically happens in B. So I wouldn't just take out A in its entirety, but just indeed reword it then in such a way that it's clear that provider sends a verification request, and then B, the registrar shall provide the information requested, basically.
Yeah, I completely agree, Marika. You're right. Yeah, A doesn't go away.
Okay. So instead of saying, for example, the provider shall perform a preliminary deficiency check of the complaint before submitting a verification request to the registrar, we could say the provider shall submit a verification request to the registrar, and the verification request will include a request to lock the domain name.
Yeah, that sounds clear and to the point.
Okay. Okay, so moving along, unless anyone else has a comment on 4A or B. Okay. Seeing their hands raised. So 4E, I see Christine made a comment that she changed the word if the provider withdraws the complaint to if the provider dismisses the complaint due to administrative deficiency. I see no problem with that change. Did anyone have any comments on that? Christine, does NAF have a different definition between withdraw and dismissing of a complaint?
Yeah, this is Christine. So a withdrawal is something that a party does. They withdraw,
okay. We
dismiss.
Okay.
I think it's just heads and tails.
Okay. And Joe, are you okay with that wording at WIPO?
That will be fine.
Okay. Okay, so moving along to the next set of comments. And I believe the next set of comments is about the suspension of a proceeding. And so I think we have a couple of things to talk about here. So the first comment that was made by both McKaylee and by Luke is page 11, 17A5, and we changed the registrar will implement the decision within 2 business days, so the registrar shall remove the lock within 2 business days. And that was the intent of the working group, I believe. That was just my mistake. Christine, you had a couple of comments, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on those for the settlement.
Right. This is Christine from NAF. So the timeline says that the parties can, provide notice, and then we acknowledge receipt of that and let the registrar know. The parties reach a settlement, provide a standard settlement form to the provider. We let the registrar know the outcome. The registrar removes the lock within 2 business days. But then it just sort of drops off. And it's my experience that parties will just forget that they're doing this. And so if you've got a 45-day stay pending, and everybody agrees to settle, and it's day 43, and so the registrar removes the lock, and 2 business days go by, there's no end date on when the parties have to actually conduct the transfer, which means that the provider is left with an open UDRP case that's at an ambiguous status. It's no longer technically stayed. We can't dismiss it. There's just sort of, it's in limbo at this point. So for my first comment, I would like to either have this specify a time period in which the actual transfer should happen, or the provider will automatically dismiss the complaint, or allow the providers to, in their supplemental rules, state what their internal rules are for how long the parties have to facilitate the transfer. Because otherwise it just gets to be, nobody's violated anything if nobody does anything.
Okay. Does anyone have anything to add to what Christine just said? I know that McKaylee, in his email and in some of his emails to me, was saying the same thing, essentially, which is just because the registrar is required to remove the lock within 2 business days, sometimes it takes weeks to get the credentials from the complainant to transfer the name. And so it's hard to have a time limit on that. But does everyone agree that we should have some sort of prescribed time limit on the amount of time that the parties have to complete their settlement?
What did Michaela say again?
Michaela's thing in relation to a settlement, and even in relation to implementing a decision, is that when originally I had in 17A5 that the registrar shall implement the settlement within 2 business days, and he said that's impossible because it takes a while to even contact the parties to get the decision implemented. And so he was kind of echoing what you were saying, Christine, and that sometimes there's this never-ending cycle of the registrars trying to hunt down the parties, and there should be some sort of time limiting on that.
Right, I agree. I mean, here it looks like, as of 5, the registrar's done its business by the end of 5. I mean, after the registrar removes the lock, Luke can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the registrar is pretty much out of the game at that point. At that point, it's up to the registrant to transfer the domain name.
I believe that's correct.
I mean, there are some registrars that do it differently. I know there are some registrars that actually facilitate the settlement, so maybe that's what Michaela's talking about. We decided as a working group that we couldn't force the registrars to do that.
Okay. So does everyone think we should leave that in the provider supplemental rules in terms of how many days they will allow the parties to implement the settlement? Or do we want to codify that in the settlement section of the rule?
Well, the nice benefit to letting the providers unilaterally put it in their rules is that that makes it also possible for the providers to bend those rules if the situation is correct. You know, if the providers are being copied on a bunch of good faith efforts by the parties to facilitate settlement and it just hasn't happened, then the provider could on its own say, well, you've been trying, so we're going to, allow the rules to kind of be, bent in this case. Whereas I don't know how LIPO does it, but the way NAF does it is, we can bend the supplemental rules, but we don't bend the UDRP rules.
So you're correct on that one.
Yeah, if you put it in the UDRP, we're going to feel like, the rules, we're going to feel, obligated to, you're out. Whereas if we put it in our rules, we'll feel like, you can have 12 days or whatever.
Okay. So with something like the complainant shall confirm to the provider that the settlement has been implemented, further to the provider supplemental rules for settlement? Would something like that be okay?
Yeah, this is Christine from NAF. That sounds okay to me. I'm sure, with a little bit of time and not being on the spot, we can come up with something nice.
Okay. And then did anyone else have any more comments on the 17A6? I see Luke is typing. I don't know if that's in relation to this.
Hey, this is Matt. Just one idea. I wonder if we want to leave a little discretion for the provider to note that the settlement looks like it's been implemented, even if they don't have explicit confirmation from the complainant. It may be that the domain name ownership information has all changed and the registrar has changed and all sorts of stuff has changed that looks consistent with the preceding outcome or the settlement outcome. But the complainant just hasn't responded to getting pinged by the provider. I don't know. Maybe that's not even an issue.
This is NAF. It's probably not harmful to have something like that. We mostly refuse to go and do investigation on domain names on our own. Just because, we have no idea what the parties are up to or what their discussions have been or what is happening. So having a thing in there that allows us to do that, probably neither here nor there. So, I mean, if other providers or, you know, the complainants or somebody feels like it's helpful to have it, but unless we hear from the parties that things are good to go, we're probably just going to keep nagging.
All right, that works.
Joe, would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's similar to what happens on our side. I mean, we keep track of what's happening with any settlement proceedings or implementation of decision, but we tend to hear from parties if something doesn't go, if something doesn't go the way it should, like if agreement to settlement or decision isn't implemented, that's when we hear about it. But a lot of the times we might just be copied in on a few things, but it seems to be going all right unless we actually hear from people.
Okay. So lastly, I noticed that Christina made a comment that sometimes the parties stipulate that the dismissal should be with prejudice.
This is Christine from NAF. We let the parties, it's up to the parties how they want to. I mean, a lot of times that's actually key. It's fine. The respondent says, I'm going to transfer this domain name to you, but you're going to release me from whatever, and you're never going to be able to file a UDRP again for this domain name if something else should happen or whatever. So I know that that is often a contingency. So, and in fact, if the parties actually submit a withdrawal request, which is a possibility during the stay, I mean, it's not common. They'll just usually wait for the stay to end, but they could actually submit a withdrawal while the stay is pending, at least with NAF, and they can request a withdrawal or a dismissal with prejudice or without. So I think that would violate what people are currently doing, what the practice is, if we require them to dismiss without prejudice.
Okay. So would changing that to the provider will dismiss the proceedings cure that issue?
Yeah, I think so, just not specifying how it will be dismissed.
Okay.
I mean, I guess at a minimum you could say, one thing, I mean, maybe WIPO wants to weigh in, but you could say the provider will dismiss the proceedings, you know, according to the specifications of the parties, which shall be without prejudice unless otherwise, you know what I mean? Something like,
yes.
So the default is without prejudice unless the parties have stipulated otherwise. I don't know if Joe, if you think that's important or not.
I don't think we've had quite so many settlement agreements with that condition that comes in. So I would be more inclined to leave it a little bit more on a discretion basis, so if parties really do come to that, we could do it and not stipulate it one way or another.
Right, and then what if they don't stipulate? Do you just dismiss without prejudice then?
We would tend to err on the without prejudice.
Yeah, we would too. So I don't. So my two choices would be either to leave it omitted and just let the provider current rules apply, or if you have to say something, say it's, you know, unless stipulated, they'll be without prejudice. Because then that would just, you know, basically say what the default is. But, I mean, I would just prefer to leave it open and let the provider supplemental rules govern that.
Okay. So we've now gone over all of the comments that were submitted. Did anybody else on the line, any of the registrars, have any comments on any of the edits? Okay. So it appears that no one has any further comments. So I propose to take the feedback in this call and adjust the rules accordingly and send them back out to the implementation review team and make sure that I'm on par with what was suggested during this call and in the suggestions. Does anyone else have any closing comments before we close this call?
Just one question. This is Matt. Sorry. What was the, where did we come out with on the that initial lock definition? There's some chatter back and forth about the the definition of that sort of after we'd moved down a little bit, and I just don't know where it came out, if we're going to...
Oh, that's a good question. I didn't see the chat. I hadn't had a time, had a chance to read it while I was talking. So if anybody had any comments on the lock definition, you're welcome to bring them forward.
Yes, yeah, so I'll just read into the record on the phone call. So what I copied the language from recommendation one into the chat so that if we were going to continue the discussion, we could. And it says specifically, in this context, the term lock means preventing any changes of registrar and registrant, which is actually different from the definition as posted in the document right now, which just says prevents any modification to it by the registrant. This lock should not impair the resolution of the domain name solely on the basis of the fact that a complaint under the UDRP has been filed or solely on the basis of the fact that a UDRP proceeding is ongoing. So I'm wondering if that is a material change from the agreed-upon definition now in retrospect.
Okay.
It says a set of measures that the registrar applies to a domain name, which is probably okay, which prevents, and then loops change, I think, any modification to it by the registrant. So actually, loops change is what changed the agreed-upon language. See, in context, the term lock prevents any changes of registrar and registrant.
Could we just replace to it with to the registrar or registrant?
Yeah, Luke, why did you change that? Because that was originally changed by Luke. That was a registrar or registrant was in there, but Luke was the one who suggested changing it, and I don't remember why. Maybe you can pipe in and explain why that was significant.
I see Volker has his hand raised. Volker, go ahead.
Give me a second. Should be working any time now. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please go ahead.
Ah, perfect. If you want to prevent any changes by the registrar, I think that's the reason for the lock, you would have to set the lock at the registry end, because anything that we put in place, we can remove as a registrar. So I think the edit from Luke was more, not modification on the obligation side, but more on the more a clarification of the language, because a lock that is set by the registrar that prevents any action by or modification by the registrar has yet to be invented.
Hey, Volker. This is Matt. I think the changes to the registrar portion was supposed to prevent the registrant from making changes to the registrar from shifting from one registrar to another one after the lock had been applied, not necessarily preventing the registrar from doing anything. So the registrar's conduct would just be a matter of contract between them and their registrant.
Yes. I see the point. It just wouldn't just excluding transfers not be the better formulation for that? I know that was the language we agreed upon originally. Just thinking that there must have been a reason for it, for the change. And that's the only thing I can think of. Anyway, I'm fine either way. Changes to the registrar, as Matt says, would make sense.
So maybe we leave the language that Luke proposed, if you and Volker agrees with, which prevents any modification to it by the registrant, but then you just add a part relating to preventing transfers between transfer to a new registrar. So that would keep
actually. The transfer is already a modification by the registrant. It's a modification of the registrar, and only the registrant would be able to initiate the transfer. So. If we have the language that Luke proposed, which prevents any modification to it by the registrant, that would, per definition, include a transfer, at least in my book. But we can clarify.
Oh, I understand. Okay, so I guess, yes, yeah, so that I was taking it to mean that the modification by the registrant would just refer to like registrant details, et cetera, not the, or you know, changing to a new registrant. But modification by the registrant would include the register. Okay, interesting. Do you think, is that pretty commonly accepted? Or understood, I guess?
I would hope so.
So are we saying that we would want to leave the definition that Luke proposed?
I think in the work group, there was a concern that preventing any modification was maybe a little bit too broad, that the only thing that needed to be prevented were changes to the registrant itself, but you could change the billing contact, for example, if your billing contact changed, or you could change an administrative contact or DNS servers. And if we say prevent any modification, we maybe our exceptions for just the domain resolution of the domain name or renewal of the domain name may not be broad enough to permit those sort of other changes that aren't changes to the registrant information or to the registrar, or that prevent the change of registrars after the lock has been applied. Does that make sense? I don't have a problem with what Luke's saying. I just think it's a little bit broader than what came out of the working group.
Okay. Volker, did you have any comments on that?
Sorry, I was just distracted for a second. Can you repeat the question again?
So I believe, and Matt, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the definition that Luke proposed, which says, which prevents any modifications to it by the registrant, I think Matt is saying that perhaps that's a little bit too broad, because the working group may not have, for example, wanted to block the registrant from allowing it to change its billing contact, for example, and if we need to make that a more narrow definition.
Well, speaking frankly, on our side, when we lock a domain name, every contact detail is locked because we cannot lock single contact details. While we can, of course, do it manually at the request of a customer, an automated system lock everything. So in practice, the language reflects at least our registrar's current action method.
Okay, so you are okay with the definition that Luke proposed then and don't think we need to add anything?
Yeah, and I think Luke also explained in the chat right now that this definition meets the intended protection of the status quo, so that's I think that's workable.
Okay. Christine's hand is raised. Go ahead, Christine.
Yeah, thanks. This is Christine from NAF. So say I put the part of the recommendation 4 into the chat, and I probably should have noticed this. I should have compared the two documents when I did my initial review. But I'm not seeing where we codify that in these rules as far as what can be changed and when. So can you help me out with that? It sort of talks about some of the questions as far as when the registrant information can change under the lock and what if there's a privacy service and who the respondent is and those sorts of things. And I didn't see that in this document when I reviewed it the first time. So does the recommendation 4 stuff not make it in?
I think so. When I was putting the recommendations in, I wrote which one was going where. And so I think that is in 4B.
That's it. There it is. Yeah.
And so I don't know if that needs to be edited a little bit. Any updates to the respondent's data, such as through the results of a request by a privacy or proxy provider to reveal the underlying customer data, must be made before the 2 business day period concludes or before the registrar verifies the information requested and confirms the lock to the UDRP provider, whichever occurs first. Any modifications of the respondent's data following the 2 business day period shall be addressed by the panel.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Yeah, I missed that. No, I appreciate that. And then the other thing is that I didn't see, because this is the rule, is recommended where did we have recommendation to? I should have, like, run this back and forth. So recommendation.
No, that's okay. I think recommendation 2 is, we just deleted that the complainant needs to state that a copy of the complaint was submitted to the respondent. So that was just completely removed from the sequence of events there. Does that look okay to you, Christine?
That looks great. Thank you. Thanks for refreshing memory.
Oh, no problem. Bulger, you had your hand raised. Did you have something that you wanted to say still?
No, that was, I put it in the chat instead. I supported the proposal from Matt, which I think is the best flexible term for that, for the block term.
Okay. So I will take a look at that and try to incorporate it into the definition of lock. I think that looks good. Okay, with that being said, did anyone else have any closing comments? Are we okay with the proposed modification to the rules? Okay. I see Lucas typing. Okay. So seeing as there are no more hands raised and no one else appears to be typing in the chat, I think we can go ahead and end this call. I wanted to say a special thanks to those of you who went through the document and added comments. They were very helpful. Thank you all for joining today and providing a robust discussion on these definitions. It's very helpful to hear from the providers that are actually processing these complaints and the registrars that are taking it from the business end and telling us in practice what the locking is and what they do. And so it was very helpful. For those of you traveling to Singapore, I wish you safe travels. And I think at this point I can take this, I will edit the document according to what we talked to today and then send it back out to the group. And if anyone thinks that we need to have another call about the definitions, we can, but I don't think that will be necessary. And then I'll bring it back to staff. So with that being said, thanks again, and I hope everyone has a great morning, afternoon, and evening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.